Good morning and welcome to ISIS Malaysia. Excellencies, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. Today we have a very interesting speaker on a highly topical subject, Syria, in everyone's news. If I may just briefly introduce Mr. Tamim Madani, the speaker today. Mr. Madani is currently chargé d'affaires in the Embassy of the Syrian Republic in Malaysia, and previous to that, he was with the Foreign Ministry in Syria. Without having to go through his complete bio, it's there in front of you. And of course, we also welcome his wife, Ms. Nala. Welcome. And Mr. Madani will talk for about 25 minutes, and then after that, we can open the floor to questions and answers. All right, Mr. Madani.
Good morning. Good morning to you all. Thank you, Mr. Boon, for this introduction. I would like first to say that I am very happy and privileged to be here at this prestigious institution. It's an honor for me to try to talk about the events in my country. Hopefully to explain to a Malaysian audience and others our point of view of how things are going. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to take this opportunity to present to you, hopefully, very briefly, the Syrian narrative of the events in Syria. An account of how we Syrians, not just diplomats or government officials, who remain loyal to the state and still believe in a bright future of our country, perceive this crisis and the potential for peace in my country. Let me go back to in 2002. I still remember the day while I was working as chief of staff for Walid al-Muallim, who was then assistant minister of foreign affairs and our current minister of foreign affairs, when he called me into his office and asked me to dig up a report he had come across while serving as Syrian ambassador to Washington. A report that advocated a Middle East policy for Israel to adopt with the help and blessing of its eternal patron, the United States, of course. The minister could not remember the name of the author of that report, but he wanted me to find it and summarize it for him, because as he thought, or rather he predicted, in my opinion, he thought it would serve as the basis for U.S. and Israeli policy for years to come. It did not take me long to find what I had looked for because I had read that report. In 1996, a group of US neocons led by Richard Perle and David Wormser drafted a policy document that was prepared then for Benjamin Netanyahu, who was prime minister at the time, with the declared objective of shaping Israel's future and guaranteeing its survival by ensuring the cooperation of its more moderate neighbors in the region, including Jordan and Turkey, and by containing its most stubborn enemies, primarily Syria and its ally Hezbollah in Lebanon. Why Syria? It was alongside Lebanon, the immediate neighbor of Israel, that has not signed the peace treaty with the Zionist state. And along with Hezbollah, the only power left at Israel's borders that threatened its safety. Since its independence, Syria had never wavered, and its commitment to the Palestinian cause and support for the Palestinian and Lebanese resistance against Israeli occupation was never in doubt. It has also never relinquished its sovereignty over the Syrian Golan that Israel had occupied by force in 1967 and illegally annexed in 1981. The Perle report I mentioned earlier, entitled Clean Break, elaborated a new approach to solving Israel's security problems in the Middle East, with an emphasis on what it called Western values. This white paper advocated an aggressive and destructive policy to be pursued by the Zionist state and the US, a policy that actively called for the removal of Saddam Hussein from power in Iraq, and I quote from that study, the containment of Syria by engaging in proxy warfare on Syrian soil and highlighting its possession of weapons of mass destruction. This is a quote from the policy paper itself. These were some of the most important elements and desired actions of this policy, actions that are in full swing today and actually continue to shape the crisis in Syria. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the basis for the crisis in Syria. Containment, engaging in proxy warfare in Syrian soil, and highlighting the possession of weapons of mass destruction. We'll come back to that. Sure enough, getting rid of Saddam Hussein, who had already been weakened by a devastating war and subsequent sanctions, required an unjustified war that caused hundreds of thousands of casualties and inflicted irreparable damage to a region already suffering from enormous challenges, caused primarily by the existence of a Zionist, racist, terrorist, and expansionist entity called Israel. And secondly, of course, by the dangerous rise of extremist ideology, whether it be it in the form of Wahhabism or the Muslim Brotherhood or other distortions of Islam, ideology that was, for the lack of a better way to describe it, weaponized or militarized in the 1980s by the US and company in Afghanistan as a pretext to curb the Soviets, and later in Iraq as a direct result of the 2003 US invasion. You see, the common denominator here is the same culprit, the US. Please remember that terrorists like al-Zarqawi and associates and their followers, who later formed their own offshoots of extremist terrorism, the Islamic State in Iraq, the so-called Islamic State in Iraq, later becoming known as Daesh in Syria and Iraq, along with other deviant groups, had their origin in Afghanistan and Iraq. They were not born in Syria due to the crisis. They were there before. They just happened to move into Syria because of the crisis. So there was a chance to implement the clean break policy recommendations in 2006. This is when the US was still in the middle of its messy war in Iraq. That same year, Israel lost its war it had launched against Syria's most faithful ally, Hezbollah, in Lebanon. The humiliation of the defeat was unbearable for the Zionists as much as it was, of course, for the Americans and the allies in the region, some of them known as Arab moderate states. The destruction of Syria, the country that was considered a lifeline for Hezbollah and a stern opponent of normalization of relations with the Zionist state, became an even more urgent priority. The US and Israel remained on course to undermine the Syrian state at any cost, including by trying to place it at the center of what Condoleezza Rice, then the US Secretary of State, coined as the New Middle East, or otherwise known as the constructive chaos theory, which stipulated that blood must be shed in order to bring about a new order in that region, which was rich in hydrocarbons, of course, something very close to what Richard Perle and Company had concocted. This is, ladies and gentlemen, the origin of the crisis in Syria, in my opinion. Now, some of you might say that you cannot pin the whole crisis in Syria on the need to guarantee Israel's security. I say, perhaps I can. But let me touch upon other factors as well. Some have argued that there were also economic reasons to subvert an independent Syria. The issue of competing gas pipelines, one from Qatar to Turkey, opposed to one from Iran to the Mediterranean Sea, both, of course, passing through Syria, has been always suggested. While this remains to be seen, it is a suggestion, it is possible, but we cannot rule it either in or out. So, but it's also possible, yeah, this is a good reason why some countries decided that they needed to take charge of Syria because of those very important pipelines. Others have talked about domestic internal conditions providing for fertile grounds for rebellion, including long spans of drought in the Syrian farm belt, partly caused, as a matter of fact, by Turkey's decision to seriously decrease the amount of water of the Euphrates River flowing downstream. Also, growing youth population, unemployment, discontent in general, these are all valid reasons for discontent, yes. But are they the real reasons for the crisis? I don't think so. Perhaps one can disagree vis-a-vis the assessment of the true economic situation in Syria at that time in 2011. Please bear in mind, for example, ladies and gentlemen, that Syria was largely self-sufficient in terms of food security. The government's policy for years had been to ensure that Syria had always in stock 4 years worth of wheat and other basic staples required for the survival of the population in case of emergencies and disasters. This was true in Syria. We had that. Syria had virtually no foreign debt. Syria's completely free healthcare system was praised by the WHO. The illiteracy rates in Syria was among the lowest in the developing world. Syrian schools and universities are free, were free and still free. The cost of living was the lowest in the region. Electricity reached 90% of remote areas, not to mention all cities and towns. And I can go on and on, but I will not bore you with these details. We can discuss them later. Granted, economic dissatisfaction of the population is a very important factor when it comes to the stability of any country. But in my opinion, the political ramifications of a strong and independent and sovereign Syria confronting Israeli aggression and American hegemony remains the real reason behind this unprecedented aggression against my country. So please allow me go back to the roots also of the crisis and its developments and stages. In late 2006, the US started to finance an external opposition to Syria's ruling Ba'ath Party. This was no secret. Those exiles were largely members of the Muslim Brotherhood, which had been evicted from Syria after the bloody terrorist insurrection against the Syrian state between 1976 and 82 had failed. In 2007, a plan for regime change in Syria was agreed upon between the US, Israel, and other regional players. The aim was to destroy the resistance alliance of Hezbollah, Syria, and Iran. Again, resistance to Israel, of course. This is always the main factor. The security of Israel is always at play. The chance to get even with Syria came with the advent of what is dubiously coined as the Arab Spring. This term, synonymous with chaos, violence, and destruction, was coined in the West and propagated by the Western media to describe the upheaval unleashed in the Middle East and North Africa region. In my opinion, the West was never comfortable with this term until it became convinced that we'll never lead to real change, but to be used as a pretext to destroy the secular and stable governments in the region as part of a greater plan to destabilize the whole region itself. But the US role in the plan to undermine Syria was to provide the media and global opinion cover for the insurgency. To that purpose, it used the tool from its colored revolution toolbox. So-called citizen journalists, as they were dubbed, were recruited, trained, and provided with the video and communication equipment needed for media propaganda. Others were trained in organizing peaceful civil demonstrations. Other regional players, mainly in the Gulf, took care of the darker part of the plan. They financed and armed rebel groups, often related to the exiled Muslim Brotherhood, which had the task to instigate a wider insurgency by taking on government forces as well as the peaceful demonstrators who actually believed they were protesting for peaceful change. A main part of the scheme was the introduction of a sectarian view that would split the largely secular Syria into several constituencies. A local disturbance in Deraa, near the Jordanian border, was used to launch the uprising. Demonstrations were held, usually immediately after Friday prayers, where crowds already gathered, but soon shots were fired towards the police as well as towards the demonstrators. It was the beginning of escalation. Armed groups began targeting police and security personnel. Having colleagues killed and wounded, the government forces for a long period of time were under orders not to use live fire against demonstrators, but in some cases had to retaliate in self-defense. Dozens of policemen died at the hands of what Western media characterized as peaceful demonstrations. Here, ladies and gentlemen, I can go on and provide you with numerous examples of crimes committed against police and security forces throughout Syria in the first weeks of the crisis, but I will only mention one. This was a massacre in my hometown of Hama. This was in May of 2011, just barely 2 months after the beginning of the events in Syria. 12 policemen were dragged from their police station. Their throats were slashed, and they were thrown off the bridge into the Orontes River. And all this was taped on video, and you can still see it today on YouTube. This was the peaceful demonstration that the West was talking about, unfortunately. No one in the outside world listened to what we're saying, that this was not peaceful, that this was a violent insurrection against a legitimate government. And this is only one example I'm citing, and there are numerous examples like that. And this was, I tell you again, in the beginning, in the first 2 months. So citizen journalists focused on the victims on the peaceful demonstration side, but never mentioned those on the government side. Western media agencies followed that scheme. cells in other Syrian cities were activated. Again, so-called peaceful demonstrations were cover for a third force, as the Arab League Investigation Commission named it, which fought against government forces and also instigated the demonstrators to take up arms. This is not my language. This is a language from an investigation committee that the Arab League produced based on an Arab League decision. And this is the same Arab League that turned against Syria afterwards. But this report clearly said that there was a third force trying to instigate troubles in Syria by targeting both the government and the demonstrators in order to create a rift between the two. This report, unfortunately, never made it to the Security Council because it was retrieved the same day that it was supposed to be presented. And you can ask some members of the Arab League why they did that, because it told the truth. The U.S. government helped by issuing its own propaganda, for example, by lying about Syrian artillery deployment against demonstrators, when at that point none had yet happened. The Syrian army had not yet engaged in the crisis at that point. Western paragovernment organizations like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch joined the campaign against the Syrian government. Cyber attacks against the Syrian government news agency helped to suppress the other side of the story. Any media outlet that sided with the Syrian government or even had an objective view of the situation became a target of sanctions and boycott. Our own television could not even broadcast on satellites, except at the end on Russian satellites. So they were practically the voice of our government and of our people was blocked in Europe, in America, and in almost all of Asia. It was soon visible that the planned colored revolution strategy did not work. The Syrian state was more resilient than had been perceived. Support for the government and President Bashar al-Assad was not what the West had expected. In the meantime, the government fulfilled many of the demands the Syrian protesters had. The constitution was rewritten. Article 8, which stipulated that the Ba'ath Party was the ruling party in the state, was removed. A new law allowing the formation of new political parties was passed, and a new electoral law was also passed. And the state of emergency that was in place since 1963 was repealed. There are also numerous other economic incentives that were introduced during that time. This was early in the first few months of the crisis. The big cities, even though predominantly Sunni, did not support or join the increasing violent and increasingly sectarian armed groups. Defections from the Syrian army and government were few and unimportant. For a long time, the Syrian economy held up quite well. The general population, as well as the government, rejected the scheme of a sectarian divide. But the enemies of Syria had to increase their commitment. The Gulf countries used all their capabilities to recruit jihadis willing to fight in Syria. The CIA, using Gulf money, brought in weapons and thousands of tons of ammunition from all over the world. Again, ladies and gentlemen, this is not a secret. The Saudis themselves admitted that they were buying weapons for the rebels in Syria. A group of exiles was built up as external future government. Foreign fighters began flowing from all neighboring countries without exceptions. The numbers we have is close to 100,000 foreign fighters that entered the country mainly through the borders from Turkey, some from Lebanon, but mainly from Turkey. I myself, ladies and gentlemen, presented evidence to Mr. Kofi Annan when he was Syrian special envoy for Syria at the UN in Geneva, when I was posted there. I provided him with boarding passes, copies of passports of Yemeni, Iraqi, also Libyan fighters, Tunisians, who came through chartered flights through Istanbul Airport on Turkish Airlines and were caught in Syria. And we presented all these evidence. This was even in 2011, 2012, to the UN, but unfortunately it never made it to any serious UN session. We still have these evidence, by the way. So the foreign fighters were fueling the crisis and its humanitarian consequences. And the emergence of humanitarian needs in Syria has been linked to the emergence and escalation of the phenomenon of terrorism. You cannot separate the two. With armed terrorist groups entering populated areas, villages, and civilian neighborhoods to control them, spread terror and fear among their inhabitants, and detain them against their will to use them as human shields, and deprive them of basic services by sabotaging and destroying public utilities and basic and essential services provided by state institutions. The so-called insurgents quickly shed their colors, declaring their allegiance to Al-Qaeda and its offshoot, Daesh. The government of the Syrian Arab Republic, in accordance with its constitutional responsibilities and duties to protect its citizens, has endeavored to restore security and stability throughout the Syrian territory and to provide the basic needs of its citizens. The army and the armed forces have undertaken their national duties to defend the territorial integrity and unity of the state and to prevent terrorist threats that threaten the security and safety of Syrian citizens. But the pressure grew and the Syrian government had to retreat on certain fronts. Parts of rural Syria were soon taken over by the so-called insurgency. The population there fled over the borders or into the cities, where the insurgency forged into parts of the cities. It was difficult to dislodge without creating immense damage to the infrastructure and buildings. In most cases, the Syrian government exercised great restraint, and that is why for long periods of time there were many cities and towns occupied by terrorists but could not be liberated because of the difficulty of trying to engage in combat with terrorists and a civilian with civilians living there. At one point, ladies and gentlemen, I remember in 2014 I was doing a report to the UN, at one point, our armed forces were fighting on 452 different battles and skirmishes in one day. This is a typical day in 2014. 452 different battles in the same day. You can imagine the pressure. But when it became likely that the terrorists might not be able to overcome the Syrian army, U.S. President Obama invoked his infamous red line over chemical weapon use. This was an invitation to the insurgency side to introduce chemical weapons to the battlefield, to then blame the Syrian government, and to thereby trigger a U.S. intervention on their side. To prevent the upcoming jihadis from taking over Syria should the government fall, the U.S. foolishly planned to have U.S.-trained so-called moderate fighters take the lead in the fight, especially in the capital of Damascus. The failure of the armed groups to occupy the capital prompted the activation of the red line plan. On August 21, 2013, some chemical agent was released in a Damascus suburb. The alleged attack occurred on the same day that a UN team was in Damascus upon invitation of the Syrian government to investigate another incident of chemical agents used by the armed rebels. Immediately, videos of the alleged new attack went viral, videos that were never authenticated. It was clearly a false flag incident. But the U.S. and company tried to convince the world that the Syrian government had indeed used chemical weapons and released some flimsy claims of evidence, but no credible or verifiable evidence at all. Please remember, ladies and gentlemen, this is something the U.S. has done before. Remember Colin Powell at the UN Security Council before the Iraq War, and Tony Blair mentioning this famous 45-minute report about Iraq's WMD capabilities? We know where all that went. The West jumped on the bandwagon in the first installment in the still-running series of chemical weapons false flags, and we had one just a few weeks ago. Syria's decision to give up its chemical weapons program was born out of a conviction that they were more or less useless on the tactical battlefield, but their potential use as a strategic deterrent against Israeli aggression had proven effective. But at that stage of the crisis, those weapons had become a liability. Instead of preventing an external war, owning them was now threatening to invite one. At the same time, Hezbollah's conventional missile force had already proven in 2006 to be a good deterrent without the problems unconventional weapons carry with them. Again, remember, ladies and gentlemen, the clean break report. Focus on WMDs amid turmoil in Syria. This is the story. apparently not willing to fall into another quagmire of its own creation, the Obama administration needed a rescue line to back off from its dangerous red line. And with the help of Russia, the framework for the elimination of chemical weapons in Syria became that line. Obama could not afford another U.S. political and military blunder in the Middle East, and he was in a lose-lose situation, but could now come out of it without too much damage to his credibility. He rescues Israel from the threat of the Syrian deterrent and cashes in on a win from his peace-prized hobby horse, which is WMD disarmament. United Nations Security Council Resolution 2118 of 2013 officially ratified the framework for the elimination of chemical weapons in Syria and helped launch the Geneva talks, but the P3 made sure that it would not serve to curb the flow of terrorists into Syria. France, UK, and the US would not make any effort to stop the flow of terrorism in Syria. Syria agreed to participate in the Geneva talks out of its commitment to a political solution to the crisis. But the process proved futile, as the Syrian state did not face in those talks any serious nor capable Syrian party willing to engage in a proper dialogue to end the crisis peacefully. I know that for a fact because I participated in those talks. The opposition, backed and guided by foreign intelligence agencies, refused to accept even the most basic principles that would provide the basis for an agreement or solution. They could not even accept the basic premise that Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity should be preserved, and that no outside interference in Syria's internal affairs should be allowed. They were willing to appease to Israel just to prove their loyalty to the West. I think they were blinded by the thirst of grabbing power in Syria. In the meantime, Syria was increasingly in danger of falling into the hands of radical extremist terrorists, flowing en masse to Syria, now mainly through Turkey, with the West turning a blind eye. The Syrian government had no choice but to seek the assistance of its allies in its all-out war against terrorism. For no country in the world can withstand what Syria had to go through, including daily unspeakable acts of terror against the civilian population, bombings, indiscriminate mortar and rocket fire on neighborhoods in major cities. Imagine, ladies and gentlemen, walking down the street in Kuala Lumpur and suddenly a rocket would fall just about anywhere. This was the normal daily life of Syrians for many years in major cities. Suicide bombers, perhaps for the first time, ladies and gentlemen, I'll give you one example. A father booby-trapped his own 12-year-old girl, to blow up herself in a police station in a neighborhood of Damascus. This was in 2015, and she did it, unfortunately. These are just a few examples. Open and aggressive foreign interference by Western regional players, eager to provide financial, military, logistical, and political support for the armed terrorist groups in Syria, coupled with unilateral, coercive economic and financial measures that severely hampered the ability of the state to provide for the needs of its people, and a vicious, relentless media and fake news campaign meant to discredit the Syrian government and its institutions. In September 2015, Russia accepted the invitation of the legitimate government of Syria to help in this war. Other allies also provided various forms of assistance. Throughout the crisis, the Syrian government decreed several amnesties to those who took up arms against the state and engaged in fruitful local reconciliations, which resulted in hundreds of armed men opting to relinquish their insurrection in exchange for amnesty, many of them actually joining the army again in its fight against terrorists. The government's policy remained very clear. It vowed to continue its fights against terrorism in the country while engaging in reconciliations and peace talks at different fora. From Geneva to Astana, leading to Sochi, the Syrian government spared no effort to engage in any process that would result in a Syrian-led peaceful resolution of the crisis. We want Syrians to agree on the future of Syria, not outsiders. That's why I stress Syrian-led process. The respect of the will of the Syrian people remains the cornerstone of any solution to the crisis. But this has proven to be complicated due to foreign meddling in these processes, including direct military aggressions by uninvited foreign powers, namely the US, France, UK, and Turkey, as well as lack of commitment to peace from the foreign-backed so-called opposition. The prospects in this regard are uncertain. as long as the political will is absent, there will be no peace. Political will on the part of Syrian players who claim they are concerned about the future of Syria, and political will of the foreign parties that have influence on this crisis. The most important thing to keep in mind, ladies and gentlemen, the crisis cannot be resolved without the swift and ultimate defeat of extremist terrorism in the region. The success of efforts to combat terrorism is dependent on the effective implementation of relevant UNSC resolutions, the most important of which are Security Council resolutions for Syria, in the case of Syria, besides 1267 and 1373, which are the main resolutions for combating terrorism at the UN, are resolutions 2170, 2178, and 2199, and 2253. We can discuss them later. These resolutions are not being respected, unfortunately, and as long as the major players, including the US and its allies, continue to disregard their implementation, we will not achieve peace. Here, I cannot help but touch upon one of the biggest lies of the Syrian crisis, the so-called US-led coalition that is allegedly fighting ISIS in Syria and Iraq. Is it? To begin with, this coalition was never invited by Syria, and its presence and activities on Syrian soil and in Syrian airspace without the consent of the Syrian state is a violation of Syria's sovereignty and is viewed as an act of aggression. Not to mention that we do not believe for one second that it is there to fight ISIS. It is there to undermine the Syrian state. Look what they've done to Raqqa, which was the so-called capital of Daesh. Raqqa was a city of 300,000 people before the crisis. Now it has only 3,000 people living in it after the US bombing. There's not one single building left standing in Raqqa. And several months after the so-called liberation of that city, the city still lies in rubbles. Bodies are still in the streets. This is what the US-led coalition does. Compare that to the liberation of Eastern Aleppo, for example. I invite you to go today to Aleppo and see how things are going there after the government has retaken this part. I believe that Syria and the Syrian people are winning the war, and we are on our way to regaining our full sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity. But we also have lost a lot. My wife and I, like millions of Syrians, are deeply saddened by the fact that our children today are unable to fully experience the safety and beauty of the country we grew up in. It will take years to integrate the refugees, to rebuild, and to let the wounds and deep rifts heal. But it will be done. The resilience of Syria and the Syrians has proven to be unmatched in history. 7 years of aggression, terrorism, destruction, animosity has not reduced our resolve to survive or to rebuild an even better Syria. Damascus, the oldest continuously inhabited capital in the world, has borne for thousands of years waves of invasions and calamities, but always survived and thrived. It will continue to do so. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Hamim, Mr. Tamim. I'm struck by the fact that Syria is embroiled in this kind of nightmare, not of its own choosing, and the complications are, you know, bewildering. If what Mr. Tamim just said sounds very complex and extremely hazardous for ordinary life for people in Syria, the reality is definitely much worse than, as for example, what we hear from the mainstream media. For example, the angle that most people hear is that it's between the US, Syria, Russia, maybe Iran, and so on. But what is seldom mentioned actually is one interested stakeholder there, which is Israel. And the latest news apparently is that Israel has stepped up its stake, perceived stake in Syria, and saying and doing much more, which has invited greater Russian involvement by planning to supply Syria with new weapons, such as missiles, for its air cover. So that is likely to draw in a greater US interest again in turn. So I think the complications are getting worse by the day, not all of which are reported in the mainstream media. So I think the situation is one that leaves a lot to be desired. And given that at the same time when all these different countries are involved in this mess in Syria, the threat from Daesh has not disappeared. It's still there. The latest being that the Syrian forces have engaged Daesh elements in southern Damascus and other places as well. So I think if there's going to be any realistic, practical definition of quagmire, this is it. And given that the Trump administration has recently announced that it will step up its involvement in Syria again militarily after what it said in not wanting to do that, and with the new national security advisor, Mr. John Bolton, I think this is something that is really, really worrying. This, I think, also gives a lot of opportunities for questions and answers. So let us have some questions and answers. Please make it brief, but first identify yourself.
Thank you very much, moderator. My name is Ahmad Al-Muhammadi. I'm from International Islam University. First and foremost, I'd like to congratulate ISIS Malaysia for organizing this event. I remember this is the first time that I come face to face with the Syrian representative in Malaysia. I hope that this happened many, many years ago, since the beginning of the crisis. It is very wonderful presentation by Sheikh Tamim on the Syrian narrative, I would say. My comment about that is that this Syrian narrative is not popular in the mainstream media. That's one thing I can assure you. Because whenever we read the news, the mainstream media, we cannot find it. I watched this in the interview by President Bashar Assad many times. He said the same thing, actually. But this is not popular in the mainstream media. That is my comment. But my question here is about the interference of the foreign countries in Syrian affairs. I remember this Sheikh Said Ramadan al-Bouti said the same thing before. When Qardawi gave fatwa, which influenced a lot of Muslims going to Syria, he told Qardawi, don't meddle into the affairs of Syrian people, because I remember his words said, أنا أعتقد أن الشيخ يوسف القرضاوي لا يعرف الحقيقة في سوريا. It's very clear. And so Qardawi said that we have a sheikh in Damascus who said nothing about the atrocities committed by the government of the regime. And I believe that Sheikh Qardawi have a wrong information about that, given the fact that he is actually representing Ikhwan al-Muslimin. And we know the history of Ikhwan al-Muslimin from the beginning, since 1970s, since Marwan Hadid came to Syria. So, this external interference into Syria, is it happened recently or before? Because I read this Mus'ab Asuri's book. He said that it was happened long time ago. The second question is about the future of Syria, because I interviewed some people who are Syrian refugee in Malaysia, Malaysian who returned back from Syria, as well as who is going to Syria. They said that the war in Syria will never stop. And they don't believe it will stop because they are looking forward, that is the meeting in Dabiq and the freedom of Jerusalem. I would like to hear your comment about that. Thank you.
Should I answer me? Thank you very much. Thank you, sir, for this informative comment and question. You seem to know a lot about Syria, and you're very well informed, yes. First, just to comment on your comment, yes, Syria has lost the media war from the beginning. I'm totally honest about that. We could not keep up with the pressure of the mainstream media. We didn't have the means or the capabilities to fight this media campaign, which was very well organized. And especially when our media outlets were not allowed to broadcast, basically. So it was left up to people like me and others to try to expose the truth. But yes, it is very difficult, and we're still trying our best to spread the word. yes, indeed, Al-Qardawi did have a major effect on some Muslims who were sent to Syria to fight, under the pretext that they're fighting for Islam. I don't know why they would be fighting in Islam in Syria, which has been always the cradle of moderation and Sufi Islam and other forms of peaceful Islam. I think this is part of the plan why the Muslim Brotherhood wanted to overthrow the government. It's an old grudge. instead of fighting the real enemy in Israel, they decided to fight in Syria, which was all for the benefit of Israel again. On the question of foreign interference, yes, the foreign interference has been there for a long time in Syria. It's not new. From its independence, our first coup d'etat that was done in 1953 was led by the CIA, by the way. So yes, foreign interference was there for a long time. It's always been there. On the question of the prospects, well, we try to believe that there is a future for Syria, because we believe Syria has survived for a long time, many wars and many conflicts. And yes, if Daesh and people who follow it still believe that they have to fight the fight of Dabiq, as you call it, as you correctly mentioned, they believe that this is their destiny. Well, perhaps it is like that, but maybe not now, maybe in 100 and 200 years. We believe that it's not the time for it, and that's why we will stop them, hopefully. We'll stop them for the benefit of everybody, not just for Syrians.
Thank you. Thank you. Just to make a few points. True, you know, the mainstream media, especially Western media, have a certain perspective which is limited to say the best. But at the same time, there are some elements in it which actually try to understand the truth. Not a majority, but a minority element. For example, in the first time, the allegation of a chemical weapons attack about 5 years ago, the leading U.S. Investigative journalist, Seymour Hersh, wrote in the New Yorker magazine questioning that the allegation that the Syrian government was involved and actually suggesting it was probably the rebels that were the ones behind it. And at the on the latest allegation, the main investigative journalist in the UK, Robert Fisk, writing in the Independent newspaper, also suggested that was also again the case here. And also in BBC World, it surprised me about a couple of weeks ago, Liz Doucette, a senior correspondent, was in Syria interviewing a number of the people in Douma and actually revealing some of the things that the mainstream media most of the time do not say, going along with the common narrative, assumed an allegation of the Syrian government's involvement and so on. So these are minority elements, but they are still, I think, significant if we take the reputation of these senior journalists into account. But most of the time, I think mainstream media in the West have this common narrative, which is seldom questioned. At the same time, I think you go back to the time of George W. Bush, there was this plan to have regime change in about 6 or 7 countries in the region. Mm-hmm. These been Iraq, that's been done, Libya, that's done, Syria as well is one of them. And this was revealed to the world by none other than U.S. General Wesley Clark, who served in Bosnia-Herzegovina. He found out this plan by the Bush administration, and he just walked out of the meeting, didn't want to have anything to do with it. But he later became a presidential candidate, but did not succeed. And now today, I think what we have is a survivor of the Bush administration, a senior survivor, Mr. John Bolton, is now joined the Trump administration as national security advisor, and having also removed some of the more moderate elements in the True. Trump administration. So he has brought in his new team, determined to have regime change in various countries, including North Korea, as is mentioned. So I think all this amounts to a very worrying situation, not just in Syria, but also in Asia and other parts of the world.